Lord, please have a seat. Has he not been faithful to you? And if you're not sure how to answer that question, I hope that today you meet him and you see him for all he is, for how much he is worth, the great faithfulness of our God. Please open your Bibles to the Gospel of Mark. That's in the New Testament. It's the second book of the New Testament, Mark chapter 8. We are in a study of the whole book of Mark, titled, Who Do You Say That I Am? And that is the question that Jesus asks the disciples, and actually we'll be studying that next week. That is also the crux of where Mark in his gospel has been pointing us towards all throughout this whole book. It seems like this question keeps coming up over and over and over again. It may not be phrased exactly that same way, but it's phrased in the way that he acts, what he does. He's constantly needing and wanting his disciples to get something, to understand something. You don't understand me. You just don't get it. I've tried to talk sense into you and you don't get it. You don't see. How many times, Pastor Jeff, Pastor Bill, have you heard things like that sitting in an office with a couple going through a difficult day of marriage? A struggling wife, a frustrated husband, going really through the same issue, but seeing it from a different angle. One believing they see something very clearly, and the other saying, you don't have a clue. So close, but yet so far. Getting people to truly understand something is incredibly difficult. Can I get an amen? Not too loudly, if you're sitting next to your spouse, especially. That's one of the reasons why I think teachers are amazing. Teachers. We got a few of them here in the room right now, right? Come on, school teachers, elementary teachers, junior high, high school, how many teachers we got? Stand up for a second. Preschool, stand up and recognize these teachers. Come on. Look at that. Bridget can't stand because she's got someone special on her lap there. Teachers, you are amazing. Come on. Calculus, grammar, you know, all of these things that teachers have a gift to take a subject that we would rather slide down a razor blade into a pool of salt. We'd rather do that than study this subject, and they have a way of turning our minds and our hearts to not only grasping it and understanding it, but sometimes loving it. God bless you, teachers. I had a few teachers in my life that were just that way, that held things out in front of me in a very special way, inspired me, grabbed me. One of those teachers, my favorite teacher, all of y'all I'm sure have your favorite, right? Most of you know him. A lot of you know him. His name was Don Hamer. And Don was our pastor at Zion Christian Fellowship. He lives with Jesus now. He went to live with Jesus in 2010. And so he's doing much better than any of us are today. I not only had the privilege of being able to sit under him as a pastor, but as a teacher. He was my sixth grade teacher at a Christian school I went to. And then he taught me in the junior as a junior year and senior year of high school, Bible and history. So loved him. Taught me so many incredible lessons. He was probably the most gifted man I ever knew as far as the level of gifts that he had. But there was one gift in particular I think he thought he had, but I don't think it was as strong as maybe he thought it was. It was the gift of matchmaking. He didn't care who you were or where you were at. He didn't care. In my case, I was a senior in high school, and he's trying to hook me up with a freshman girl, a girl named Martita. And I don't know why, he just had this inkling. If he liked you, he was going to get you to marry somebody quickly. And he wanted you to marry young and have a lot of babies, right? Have as many babies as you can, hurry up, and that way when you get old, you're still young enough to enjoy your great-grandchildren. That was his philosophy. And I remember I would, in school, I you know, we're supposed to be going over history or something, but he's pulling me aside saying, "Boy, eyes to see. If you only had eyes to see what this girl is going to be in the future, you would want to be with her." And I said, "Pastor Hamer, no, you are wrong." Nevertheless, he kept coming through almost every day. And all he would look at me, we'd be in the middle of the class, he'd look at me and go, "Boy, eyes to see." Now, when I will say, when I finally had eyes to see, he congratulated me. He said, "Now you really had eyes to see, so you did a good job." Now, why do I mention that? Because I couldn't help but hearing that echo in my mind as I read through this passage over and over and over again. It's possible to see, but not really see. How many couples have I counseled pre-marriage, and you try to teach them that there's difficult days in marriage and here's the way you need to see it, and they look at you and say, "Got it." And I look at them back and say, "No, you don't. You don't have it yet. You need your eyes to be opened. You need to see some things." And biblically speaking, spiritual eyes to see equals understanding. Okay? When we use that language, the metaphor, having eyes to see, it means truly grasping, truly understanding. And Mark is about to transition his gospel from focusing on the many different actions of Jesus in order to show his disciples primarily who he was, who he is. He's transitioning it now in chapter 8 to take us on the road to the cross. And the rest of this gospel, which is about half of the gospel, is going to focus on this road to the cross. Talked about teachers. Jesus is a teacher. His disciples are in the classroom. He's trying to get a lesson across. Next week, we'll get straight at the answer to the straight-out question that Mark has been pounding us with all throughout this gospel. He needs the disciples to have eyes to see. The events of the passage we're going to read today are primarily for the disciples. They will soon be sent out to continue his work, his mission, and the success of that mission depends on them having eyes to see what Jesus needs them to see. Not only the success of their mission, but their salvation, their eternal joy, their peace, their very purpose for living depends on seeing Jesus accurately. And as Jesus is beginning the road to the cross, he intensively and deeply needs his disciples to know who he really is. In essence, he's saying, focus on who I am, not just on what I am doing. Oh, watch what I'm doing, but understand that because of who I am, that is what gives the meaning to what I do. And they don't quite understand. Today and throughout the rest of chapter 8 in the coming week, Jesus is challenging these men to examine their hearts, to get a key understanding into their heads. And the same holds true for us today at the outset of the passage. And so, Christian, this message is for you today. And I want to challenge you today. How does your understanding of who Jesus really is affect how you live daily life? Does it have any influence? Does it change how you see everything in life? Let the Holy Spirit expose your heart today. Examine how you live, and maybe even more important, why you're living that way. Ask yourselves, am I living the kind of life that I want my son to live, that I want my daughter to live, that I want my best friend to live? And if not, why not? And I believe if you look hard enough, and if God is gracious, which He is, I believe you'll find that the answer is the same answer that the disciples will be discovering. It has to do with the belief, and even more, not only the belief, the conviction. Your beliefs are what you live for. Your convictions are what you're willing to die for. And so it has to do with the belief and the conviction that Jesus is the Christ, the Son of the living God. But my failure to see Him, to really see Him, and then to embrace all He is, will show, and it will display itself in a lack of love and commitment ultimately to Him. It's the mentality of, I believe in Jesus, but. And oh, how I want you to see Him today. The main idea of this verses 1 through 26 is this: because our eternal joy, peace, and purpose depend on it, we desperately need God's gracious gift of eyes to see who Jesus really is. John Piper said, Jesus Christ, the divine person revealed in the Bible, has a unique excellence and a spiritual beauty that speaks directly to our souls and says, quote, yes, this is truth. It's like seeing them. It's like seeing the sun and knowing that it is light. It's like tasting honey and knowing that it's sweet. This is my prayer for us today, that we see Christ for real with the eyes of our heart. Would you pray with me as we begin the passage? Father, I ask, O God, that You would be gracious to us today. Grip our attention, O Father, for these few moments we're together, as we read through Your Word and as we hear these words of Christ, as we see this glorious picture of Christ, Lord, change us today. Let us see You for real in Jesus' name. Amen. Mark chapter 8, verse 1 through 26. In those days when a great crowd had gathered and they had nothing to eat, he called his disciples to Him and said to them, I have compassion on the crowd because they've been with Me now 3 days and have nothing to eat. And if I send them away hungry to their homes, they will faint on the way. And some of them have come from far away. And His disciples answered Him, how can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place? And He asked them, how many loaves do you have? And they said, 7. And He directed the crowd to sit on the ground, and He took the 7 loaves, and having given thanks, He broke them and gave them to His disciples to set before the people. And they set them before the crowd. And they had a few small fish. And having blessed them, He said that these also should be set before them. And they ate and were satisfied. And they took up the broken pieces left over, 7 baskets full. And there were about 4,000 people. And He sent them away. And immediately He got into the boat with His disciples and went to the district of Dalmanutha. Verse 11, the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. And he sighed deeply in his spirit and said, why does this generation seek a sign? Truly I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation. And he left them and got into the boat again and went to the other side. Now they had forgotten to bring bread, and they only had one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, watch out. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. And they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus was aware of this and said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Do you not perceive or understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? They said to him, 12. And the 7 for the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. And he said to them, do you not yet understand? And they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand and led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked, do you see anything? And he looked up and said, I see men, but they look like trees walking. Then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes. His sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, do not enter the village. What does Jesus want his disciples to understand about him? There's 4 things that we pull out of this passage this morning. Remember the context. Jesus had just healed the deaf man, the mute man. The people were celebrating. They had just said, he does all things well, and he's out again in this area, primarily a Gentile area, and starts teaching. And even though he's going to do this, he does this incredible miracle, which is not just some people believe that there's a mistake or something, like, well, the feeding of the 5,000 is the same as the feeding of the 4,000. These are two separate events. We went over that a few weeks ago. The feeding of 5,000, which was probably upwards of 20,000 people, that was done in the nation of Israel. This is outside the boundaries of Israel now, primarily dealing with a lot of Gentile people. And he's about to do this great work again, but even in the midst of doing this great miracle, he has a purpose, I believe, even bigger than just feeding their hungry stomachs. He's training his men. He's giving his disciples a lesson because he needs them to see something. What does he want them to understand about him? Point one is this, that he is the one with power to provide because he cares for us. Just as he needs his disciples to see this, we need to see the same thing. Jesus is the one with power to provide because he cares for us. Let's look at verses 1 through 10 again and pay attention to how he provides here. It says that when the crowd had gathered, they had nothing to eat, but he called his disciples to him. He didn't have to do that, right? He could have just started the work all on his own. He's involving these men. He calls to them and he tells them, I have compassion on the crowd. Why? Because they've been with me now for 3 days and they have nothing to eat. We're out in this desolate wilderness place, and these people have sat with me and been listening to my teaching and my preaching for 3 solid days. They've got nothing to eat. If I just send them home and dismiss them now, they're going to just wither away and faint on the way. Jesus, in the feeding of the 5,000, it also says he had compassion on them, but it was a little different reason. In that passage, it said it's because he saw them as sheep without a shepherd. They were lost and confused, and he cared for them. In this case, he actually literally cares for their physical needs. He knows that their stomachs are growling and they haven't eaten in several days and they have a long journey home, and he cares enough to want to provide for them. Then he involves the disciples. He has a purpose. He needs them to see something about this. When he turns and asks them the question and gives them the understanding that he has compassion on them, in verse 4 it says, his disciples answered him, "How can one feed these people with bread here in this desolate place?" Now I ask you, did they forget? We look at them. When I read that passage, again, I'm looking at them thinking, just a couple chapters ago, he just did this with 20,000 people. What are you guys doing? But then it struck me. Man, I do the same thing. My heart went out to these guys. How often do you forget? We just sang, "Great is thy faithfulness. Morning by morning, your mercies are new." But then we wake up tomorrow grumpy. Bad attitude, complaining. Like we forgot all about the fact that he does truly care for us and provides for us and is faithful to us. How soon did they forget, but how soon do we? Then he gives them a few lessons that he wants them to learn. The first is he cares, so he provides all that is needed. And again, he has the power to do this. Then it's something that's interesting to me. He looks at them in essence says, "And then I'm going to work with what you got." He says, "How many loaves do you have?" Right? They forgot all about the first miracle. That's way behind them. They're not having a whole lot of faith at this moment. So Jesus says, "All right, this is where you are. I'm just going to start right where you are, and I'm going to work with what you got. How many loaves do you have?" And if you look throughout the scriptures, this is the way that God regularly deals with men. Think of Moses. Moses stands in front of the burning bush, remember? And it's flaming and burning the presence of God, and he sends them to Egypt. He says, "I want you to go declare, stand in front of the most powerful man in the world and demand that he let the people go." And Moses is like, "Who am I? You got to do something about that." And what is God's response to him? He says, "Moses, what's that you got in your hand?" It's a staff. He says, "Throw it down." He throws it down, and you remember, and it turns into a snake. He says, "Pick it up," and he picks it up, and he becomes a staff again. He's revealing his power, but he wants to know, what do you have in your hand? What are you carrying with you right now? What have you been given today? Start where you are and work with what you've got. Give that to God. They also had fish, right? He asked them about the loaves. Then we find out a few verses later, "Oh, and we've got some fish too." And it doesn't say it in there. And I speculated when I read. I said, I wonder if they kept that from Jesus. I wonder if they said, "Okay, here's the loaves, because you asked us about that, but don't tell Jesus about the sardines. He's going to give them away. That's for us." No, Jesus says, "Give me everything. Give me all the bread you got. Start with what you've got, and I'll take care of it." The Bible tells us in Matthew chapter 6 that he feeds the birds of the air, right? But how does he do that? Does he drop worms from the sky? I hope not. It wouldn't be a fun shower. Now all the birds get up, and the early bird gets out and gets the worm, right? God says, "I'm behind all of that." The story was told of a young man who had become a Christian, and he was so excited about the Lord, and he wanted to grow in the Lord, so he went out in the wilderness on a personal retreat to pray. And as he was praying, he was walking alongside of a country road, and a bread truck drove by, and a loaf of bread falls out of the back of the truck. He saw that as an answer to prayer, because he had been praying, "Lord, give me some food. I'm hungry. I'm withering away." And so this bread truck, loaf of bread rolls out the back, and he says, "God, if that loaf of bread is from you, have it float in the air over to me." Guys, there comes a point in time, and don't in any way take this to say that God doesn't do all the work, but how does God work? He works through you and through me. And there's a lot of times where we're sitting there waiting for something to fall out of the sky, and God says, I've already put it in your hands. You just don't think it's enough. It's not sufficient for you. You're not trusting me enough. So he takes what we've got. He says, I'll work with what you've got. I'll start with what you've got, disciples. Then I'll make it all sufficient. I'll multiply it. And that's what he did with this bread. He takes this bread and says, and he broke the bread and he gave thanks. And the original language implies that he just kept breaking it. Boom, passing it out. There was a never-ending supply until all was filled, and then there was a lot of extra, right? They got all these baskets full of extra. What is he doing? He's feeding them, but he's doing more. He's showing his disciples who he is. He cares enough to provide all that is needed. He'll start with what you got, with where you are, and then he'll make it sufficient. He'll multiply it enough. But you got to take it and pass it out. God always upholds his responsibilities. But he also gives men responsibilities. He says, you need to sow. You need to plant some things in the ground. That's your responsibility. My responsibility, Christian, is to give you the harvest. And the size of the harvest and the timing of the harvest is all on his. It's up to him. We don't determine that. But if you're standing around with a shovel in your hands and he's telling you plant some seeds and you just stand there saying, God, grow this fruit, grow this fruit. Are we not seeing something? Are we not trusting him? Now, please hear me. I am not preaching works salvation. I'm preaching works as a result of salvation. You've been saved for something, for good works. God wants you to get out and do something with your life that is going to impact eternity. He wants you to do it in a way that's trusting him. He's calling his disciples to do this very same thing. And then I believe this whole miracle is summed up in the great teaching we get from John 6:35 that he is the bread. He wants them to see something spiritual, something much greater than just the fact that the stomachs were filled. But it's the fact that he is the bread of life and he is the all-sufficient one. Sufficient for what? For all of your joy, for all of your peace, for all of your purpose, for the very reason you live today. He is the bread. And Jesus here considers his disciples' understanding of his feeding the people as the necessary prerequisite to their understanding of who he is. He who stands before them is none other than the eternal creator and the giver of life. He needs them to know that. And church, he needs you to know that too. He needs us to know that in the middle of needs, true needs and difficulties. In the midst of the storms of life. I thank God for men like Dick Jekyll and Jack Lister who are here faithfully, despite the fact that their wives have been suffering. Smiles on their faces, blessing us. Maybe they've learned some of these secrets here that we need to learn. That in the midst of terminal illness, even, you don't lose sight of the spiritual realities of eternal health and life. It gives us courage to face the future, to stand up to fears and difficulties, and to look at God and to keep our eyes on him and to say, the Lord gives and the Lord takes away. Blessed be the name of the Lord. He is the one with power to provide because he cares for us. He cares for you. And point two, he is the one who is opposed by hard-hearted unbelief. In verse 11, the people are all fed and they've left and Jesus has gone on, and it says the Pharisees came and began to argue with him, seeking from him a sign from heaven to test him. That word test literally means to tempt. It's the same word that is used of Satan when he tests Jesus in the wilderness. And look at Jesus' response in verse 12. And he sighed deeply. We saw that sigh last week, didn't we? That sigh of compassion, the heart driven in compassion, as Dr. Gamble shared with us last week. Today, the sigh is a bit different. A sigh of frustration, maybe even of righteous anger. He sighed deeply in his spirit and said, "Why does this generation seek a sign? Truly, I say to you, no sign will be given to this generation." Now, you've already seen this throughout this gospel. The Pharisees were not blinded physically to the miracles of Christ. They had seen him do mighty and powerful works. They'd seen him do things no man can ever do, and yet they hated him for it. And so when they're seeking a sign here, they're not turning into seekers, like somehow they're interested in Jesus. Their plans remain the same as they did a few chapters ago. How can we trap him? How can we kill him? This is the evil of a hard heart. This is the depth of unbelief and where it goes. Unbelief is when you can't see, and not only can you not see, you don't even want to see. And this is where these guys are at. And so Jesus sighs deeply to them and he says, you're wanting me to perform some extra special heavenly sign for you to prove that I'm God. I've already proven I'm God. And even if I did it again, you wouldn't believe. Your heart is hard. And so, in frustration, he sighs deeply and he again says, don't be seeking signs. I'm not giving any sign to this generation. This passage, which is also retold in Matthew, adds a little bit of extra detail where it says, the only sign I'm going to give you is the sign of Jonah. Which, in essence, was a way of saying, just as Jonah was in the belly of the fish for 3 days, Jesus is going to be in the grave for 3 days, and on the third day, he's going to rise. He says, you want to see my power? You want to see who I am? I'm going to rise from the dead. That shows the whole world who I truly am. But the settled unbelief of the Jewish leaders here, again, has a greater purpose. And this settled unbelief ends up becoming an object lesson and a serious warning for the disciples by the means of a metaphor. He uses this metaphor of leaven in the following verses, which ultimately points to the malicious self-sufficiency that the Pharisees had and the hypocritical self-righteousness that they displayed. We see this in the depth of unbelief. God's not shocked and surprised at it, though the disciples may have been. Hard for us who love Christ and love God to look at a world that hates him and think, how can you hate God? How can you not trust him? How can you not believe him? How can you not follow him? And yet this is the danger of unbelief. And even us as lovers of God, we can fall into a trap of letting unbelief creep in. And there's constant warnings throughout the New Testament, don't let unbelief creep in. And you think, oh, no, of course not, I believe in Jesus. But turn your eye attention to Romans chapter 1 for a minute. Verse 18 says, "For the wrath of God is revealed from heaven against all ungodliness and unrighteousness of men who by their unrighteousness suppress the truth. For what can be known about God is plain to them because God has shown it to them. For his invisible attributes, namely his eternal power and his divine nature, have been clearly perceived ever since the creation of the world in the things that have been made. And so they are without excuse." That is a clear passage, is it not? Say, look, there's a lot of people that they say they don't believe in God, but they actually really, they know him. Deep down, they know he's there. They just suppress that truth. It's the picture of the beach ball in the pool. You ever gone swimming with a beach ball? And you push it down, and you push it, and you work really hard to push it down. What happens? Psh, psh, comes right back up. That is the way truth functions. That's the way God is. You can try to push that truth down all you want. It's going to keep coming up, keep coming up. But then people begin getting more irritated by it. But God says they're without excuse for verse 21. For although they knew God, they did not, look at these two things. They didn't honor him as God. Okay, guys, we're talking about the depth of depravity here. This is non-believers, Romans 1 speaks of. Okay? What is their crime? They know God, but they don't honor him as God. They don't acknowledge him as God. They won't step down from the pedestal long enough to say, God, I acknowledge you. And then secondly, they don't give thanks to him. Now again, this passage speaks of the unbelieving world, but I challenge us as those who would claim to be believers in this place today, don't we do the same thing sometimes? We don't acknowledge God, his presence, his power, his ability, his care, his love. And we don't respond with thankfulness as often as we should or could. These are the Pharisees, and they're the bad guys, right? That's the dark side of the New Testament. But what about the good guys? What about these 12 disciples, these guys who have forsaken all to follow him? They laid it all down. Great men, right? And they are. What about them, though? Well, point number three, he's the one who exposes the heart. He exposes the heart. Verse 14. Now they had forgotten to bring bread. Whoops. And they had only one loaf with them in the boat. And he cautioned them, saying, so here this picture, they're in the boat rowing across the other side. They got one loaf of bread with them. And Jesus says, after this altercation with the Pharisees, watch out, guys. Beware of the leaven of the Pharisees and the leaven of Herod. He's kind of putting these bad guys in their place, the Pharisees and Herod. These are the ultimate and the bad guys, if you will. He says, guys, watch out for them. Watch out for their leaven. What does that mean? You all know what leaven is, right? It's yeast. It goes in bread. And all it takes is what? Just a little bit, right? Just a little scoop of leaven goes into the whole lump, and it spreads all throughout, and it helps the dough to rise. And so Jesus is saying there's a danger in the leaven of the Pharisees, in that little bit of untruth, that little bit of unbelief that can creep in. Beware, guys. Watch out. Now, they don't understand what he's talking about here, and we're going to see that in a minute. In Matthew, it actually tells us they actually come to an understanding in the end to figure out he's talking about their teachings, what the Pharisees teach, what they believe, what they hold to, ultimately the self-righteousness, the self-justification, the works salvation of the Pharisees. So he tells them, beware of the leaven of the Pharisees. Verse 16, they began discussing with one another the fact that they had no bread. And Jesus, aware of this, said to them, why are you discussing the fact that you have no bread? Now just look at these x-ray questions he asked them. He puts to their hearts to expose to the depth of who they are and what they are, what needs to come out of that heart. He says, why are you discussing? Do you not yet perceive or understand? You guys have been with me for a long time now. You've seen me do some amazing things. There's no one like me. No one teaches like me. No one does miracles like me. You've seen it time and time and time again. And do you not yet understand? Are your hearts hardened? Having eyes, do you not see? And having ears, do you not hear? And do you not remember when I broke the 5 loaves for the 5,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? I wonder if it was like when a classroom gets scolded, teacher's really mad, no one wants to answer, or they just sheepishly, 12. And the 7. For the 4,000, how many baskets full of broken pieces did you take up? And they said to him, 7. And he says to them, do you not yet understand? And that word understand literally has the connotation of putting pieces together. It's like, guys, you've been following me. I've given you piece after piece after piece of the puzzle. I'm giving them to you. I'm keep giving them to you. I just did this again. I fed 5,000 over here. I said 4,000 over here. Here's another piece. Put it together. Do you not yet understand? But the disciples neither understand, nor see, nor hear properly. What are they focused on? We forgot lunch. We forgot lunch. In Matthew, Jesus adds, the words recorded of Jesus are added, he tells them, oh, you of little faith. They got it later because Paul, who wasn't there at the time, but the other disciples followed the same road. Colossians 3, 1 through 4, this was written, if you then have been raised with Christ, seek the things that are above, where Christ is, seated at the right hand of God. Set your minds on things that are above, not on things that are on earth. Guys, I'm trying, I'm working, I'm showing you who I am, and all you can think about is your stomach. Physical things. You can't see the spiritual behind what I'm pointing to. And Jesus ends up taking up Old Testament figures of speech, things like blindness and deafness, to describe the hard hearts of the disciples. The same thing, hear this, the same thing that was in the wicked Pharisees was in them. Self-centeredness, self-reliance, self-focus. All of it revolving around self. He wants their eyes on him. So he graciously and lovingly exposes their heart. Why? So he can do the all-important work of continuing to open their eyes, which is point four and last. He is the one who opens the eyes of the blind. Verse 22, and they came to Bethsaida, and some people brought to him a blind man and begged him to touch him. And he took the blind man by the hand, and he led him out of the village. And when he had spit on his eyes and laid his hands on him, he asked, do you see anything? And he looked up and said, I see people, but they look like trees walking. And then Jesus laid his hands on his eyes again, and he opened his eyes, and his sight was restored, and he saw everything clearly. And he sent him to his home, saying, do not even enter the village. Now, what is going on here? Was he just too tired to, like, do the miracle right? What's this rubbing his eyes and spitting in his eyes and all of this? And different commentators have some really good things to say. Some say that was something he was doing in the natural. You know how when you sleep too long and all that sleep builds up in your eye and you like wake up and you gotta like get through all the crust and open it? Some commentators actually say, well, that's what he was doing. He was just getting all that gunk out of his eyes so then he could actually do the miracle and heal him. I believe Jesus, because he loves these disciples so much, is giving another object lesson. He's teaching these disciples that he has all the power in the world to heal this blindness, and he will open the eyes of the blind. But sometimes he does it little by little, one step at a time. He wants them to see him properly. And the truth is, unless you see Jesus properly, your eyes are not fully open. But here's here's the blessing that we have as believers, church. If you can't see Jesus, or if you can't see Jesus clearly, the comfort is this: He sees you. Even on those days that it's fuzzy and hazy and cloudy, He sees you. And because He cares, because He provides, He comes and touches and opens the eyes. How patient is our God? How wonderful He is with these disciples, showing the disciples that you don't understand, you're blinded, but you know what? You're going to get it. One day, you're going to get it. You don't see it now. Don't give up. Start with what you got. Keep giving me your little loaves. And you watch what I'll do with them, guys. And these 11, we know one of them was Judas. The other 11 went out and changed the world. Sometimes our failures or our lack of seeing clearly gets us down so far, there's not even a hope to see at that point. You're not even looking. Sometimes we feel our failures more deeply than we rejoice in His victories. Every time we do that, who's the focus on? Me, self. And we're good at that, right? Come on, you go to a wedding, right? You get invited to a wedding, and who's the honored guests of the wedding? Or who's the honored ones? The bride and the groom, right? Who's it all about? It's about the bride and the groom. But there's a photographer there and taking a bunch of pictures, and they're, you know, taking pictures, and you're obviously in the pictures, right? And so you go home later that night after the wedding and all the celebration, and the pictures, people start posting them on Facebook or Instagram or wherever you watch. And so you're looking at your feed, and all of a sudden the pictures of the wedding are there. You start looking at them. Come on, be honest. Who are you looking for? You! How do I look? Did they catch me in a weird, like, big chunk of, you know, cake in my mouth or something? How do I look? How do I appear? Our eyes immediately go to me. And Jesus knows that. He knows how self-centered we are. And because He loves us and cares, He still provides our needs. Despite opposition, despite a world that hates Him, just like the Pharisees did and want to keep tearing Him down, He's got His people. And He calls them to Himself. And He brings them close. And he sometimes jabs that spear into the heart to expose it. His words sometimes will cut and open us up so we can lay bare before Him and get that all that gunk out, all that unbelief, all that fear, all that lack of trust. And then He gives us eyes to see. Eyes to see what? Eyes to see Him. Many people want to stick Jesus in their own little category. He doesn't fit. Many want to give Him part of my life. There is room in your heart for only one King. There is salvation and joy and peace and purpose for being alive in no one but Him. Are you looking for Him? Are your eyes lifted towards Him? Turn from your self-sufficiency. Turn from your self-righteousness. Tear down every self-salvation project you've been building and look to Jesus today. Take that little step of faith. Some people get so caught up in thinking, you know, that, oh, if I follow Christ, I'm going to resign. I got to resign my job and run off to Africa to the mission field. No pun intended, Pastor Jeff. It's Start where you are. What's your loaf of bread? What's in your hand? Give it to him. Trust him. Find your comfort in him. Find your purpose for living in him. The great theologian, J.I. Packer, who wrote the book Knowing God and several hundred other books, the news was just announced this week. He's 89 years old. He's almost catching up to you, Elder Stennett. He's 89 years old, and just this week he was diagnosed, well, the news came out that over Christmas he was diagnosed with macular degeneration, and he can no longer see. So he announced that his writing ministry and his traveling ministry is done. He probably deserves some rest at 89. Here's a man who's been teaching people about knowing God for decades upon decades, and when it comes down to it, how did he respond to losing his sight? And I just want you to hear this as we close. He says, overall, I'm encouraged. He says this, I don't see how any Christian, under any circumstance, can't be encouraged who focuses on God. I don't see how any Christian can be discouraged because God is in charge. God knows what he's doing. All things work together for good for those who are called according to his purpose, Romans 8:28. And our hope is in Christ. Those things don't change. And those are the things to focus on. Wise words by a man who can no longer see, but by a man who truly sees. Let's bow our heads in prayer.